Welcome here today, this afternoon. It's an honor to be here. My name is Joel Povey, and this is my wife, Hannah. And we're co-presenting today, as you know, on mental health. And we're going to get to know a little bit about us, and hopefully we can kind of introduce this subject together and, yeah, find some helpful ways through it.
Yeah, so we're excited to spend the next 45 minutes with you talking about what it means to start navigating your mental health. But this is a huge topic, as you all know, and it's like a very small amount of time to cover everything we're going to cover. So we're just going to do a very kind of brief overview of the real struggle many of us feel and have. Or if you haven't experienced it yourself, understanding what it's like for someone else alongside of you to have that. And just so you know, just get a little bit of a trigger warning. Come on in, there's room at the front.
I would love to hear that.
Yeah. So we're going to just briefly talk about a few things that could be triggering. We're going to talk a little bit about suicidal ideation, which lots of people have experienced. And so we just want to make space for that and tell you guys that. There's no surprise with that. And whatever you need to do in that moment, I just invite you to do that. If you need to close your eyes, if you need to leave, whatever you need to do in that moment, we're just letting you know that that's going to happen. And we'll briefly touch on some self-harm topic as well, just very briefly. I'm a certified Canadian counselor. I have a private practice in Saskatoon, and I meet people in a clinical setting. I work one-on-one with youth and young adults. And I love it. We do that through video sessions through the pandemic and in my office. Now I just have to do both, which I would have never done before. But, so that's what I do.
That's good. Yeah, and my name is Joel, like I said. I've been working with youth for a lot of years. That's actually kind of what drew us together. We met at a Bible camp, so shout out Bible camps. We're from one called Stony Lake Bible Camp. But I've also served I actually served an internship at Joe's Place. I don't know if anyone's from there. And then I did this last 7 years in Saskatoon at Ebenezer Baptist. So I've been a youth pastor. And it was through working closely with youth that I've kind of realized my gifting and calling towards the counseling work as well. So I'm currently a student, and I'm in a transition from being a youth pastor to being a counselor. So that's a little bit about us. We also have three beautiful children. We just like to adventure. We're really excited because we got a canoe. Mm-hmm. And we basically fell in love on a canoe, in a canoe over multiple summers. So that's cool. We got a canoe as a family now. We're going to canoe this summer with all three of them, hopefully. Yeah. So that'll be good.
Yeah.
But I also just want to share. So obviously we came together around like kind of our desire to help people and working in a camp setting. And then what was cool is when we got married and kind of realized we both had similar a Bible verse that we were both really drawn to. It's Isaiah 61. I just want to read that as we get into this topic. So this is what it says. The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me because the Lord has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for captives and release from darkness for prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and to comfort all who mourn, and provide for those who grieve in Zion, to bestow on them a crown of beauty instead of ashes, the oil of joy instead of mourning, a garment of praise instead of a spirit of despair. They will be called oaks of righteousness, a planting of the Lord for the display of his splendor. So that Bible verse, it's speaking of the reality of God as like a healer and a restorer. It's really actually talking about the mission of God and the desire of God since the beginning of creation. It's also the Bible verse that Jesus quoted when he arrived to announce his mission and his fulfillment of God's mission when he walked on earth. And like within that verse, Hannah and I both feel like we've actually tasted of that in a personal way, like the healing ministry of Jesus and that like restoration and that thing that we've tasted and we've seen that who Jesus is and what he does in our life. And now we get to be part of joining him and helping that happen in other people's life. And the beautiful part of being human is that this is part of how God has designed us. It's like we grow, we adapt, we heal. It's actually a very beautiful built-in part of who we are that gets fulfilled through Jesus. So I also just want to set down like an important foundation, because sometimes we like think about mental health. It's kind of, it can be very like psychological, science-y, and you know, those are realms that actually don't make reference to God, and that's like in their definition of how they've built that body of knowledge and some of that wisdom, is that it's not in reference to God. And obviously here we are in a Christian setting, and many of us are coming from that perspective, and it's really important that we can actually integrate those two together. So something that's been helpful for me, and like kind of a basis of what we're going to be talking about, is that mental health is part of, like, integral part of the mission of God. We are not just physical or mental or spiritual beings. We are it's all tied into each other. It's all spiritual. It's all part of God's design for healing and wholeness and the well-being of not just individuals, but families, communities, the earth, the cosmos, all of humanity. You know, it goes all the way. So I just wanted to say that, and to say that, like, we believe that all healing, wherever it's happening, even if it's not in the name of Jesus, all healing that's happening is actually God at work in the world. And all truth that is discovered is God's truth. God is the God of truth. Jesus is the truth. So we're going to be looking into some different fields and different things, but there are really important resources that are God-given in the medical community and the psychological community. We're going to explore some of those today.
Yeah, so this is kind of our perspective on mental health. Also, there's lots of perspectives, but this is kind of where we come from. And throughout all of our years in youth ministry, this is kind of what we have learned in working with different age groups and people experiencing significant and a range of mental health issues.
Yeah. So we just want to talk a little bit about development, like brain development and just human development. And this is like actually the design of God. So it's just kind of a crazy time that we call adolescence. It's like, you know, anywhere from 12, but could be younger than that, to like 25, could be older than that. There are just basically an overwhelming amount of changes happening in your, like, in the unseen, in your mind and in your body. And they're all connected. And this is actually just how human beings work. One of the metaphors for human development is like a seed. And if you think about a seed, it's like the environment changes around them. There's like genetic potential inside that seed. And it's kind of a miracle every spring where we see that, like, all of a sudden, spontaneously, there's like this transformation. For us as humans, it's like both physical and it's, you know, mental. So obviously we know about puberty, but also there's like internal and social things are changing so rapidly around you during this season that can be expressed in just like your involvements around school, interests, friends, groups. There's a natural kind of like shift in the way that you relate with your parents and the way that you relate with the world around you. And all of this is actually activating and bringing on board like new mental abilities that are like new and being tested and just coming forth. So your rational reasoning skills, but also moral judgments. Yeah. And then through all of this, you're just expected to have this like emerging sense of self and identity. And all of that is just coming on board in new ways. So we just want to acknowledge this like unique kind of developmental, period. And, yeah, it's wild.
Yeah, so the reality is that we don't know fully who we are in our adolescence. We maybe never really know, but we start to identify those things as teenagers. But what we can know as we're moving through these times is knowing how to have access to our emotions. Emotion is very important. So with knowing it's okay that some days you feel really overwhelmed with all of these changes, it's okay to feel excited sometimes, happy, sad. It's really important as we're processing this that we don't shut our emotions off, but that actually we learn to have access to our emotions. So during the season of constant change, our physical and mental health is pushed to its limits, and it goes to a high stress point for us.
Yeah, and, you know, we want to acknowledge that and normalize that it's okay to feel, like, completely overwhelmed and stressed and struggle with your mental health, because it's actually very appropriate developmentally, and you're not alone in that. And it probably feels big, and it is. That's just part of the season. But what's really cool is it's actually a unique period for God to do things in your whole being, because as you can see from this picture, your brain is, like, essentially, it's like malleable. It like can change. It can like heal. It can grow in some different ways. Because it's just like kind of, brain plasticity. But what happens when you move out of adolescence is like some of that stuff like firms up and you're like getting set into who you are as an adult. And unfortunately, people often don't seek mental health, until it's too late or until you're in a crisis mode. But if you're willing, like the fact that you're here and you're like interested in mental health and you're like even asking the question, how's my mental health? Mm-hmm. Is really cool because you can make some really cool changes now that are going to positively impact yourself and the world, like moving forward. So it's an exciting time.
Mm-hmm. So in this vulnerable time, it's really important that we start to know ourselves. So when we're gaining, we start to gain self-awareness of how we're doing mentally and how that could affect every area of our life. Working on our own therapeutic process, that's kind of becoming aware of yourself. It's a place to start moving forward. So I really like this image. So this can happen through a meeting with a capable or safe adult or a counselor, where we can kind of discover in sometimes unbiased ways and be able to speak out kind of what's going on for us. And then that's where we can kind of start building those coping strategies is with those safe adults and other people. It's a really great place for us to start is by talking to some other people who are at a different part of the journey. So many of you have heard the analogy of a toolkit, and you probably heard that even of a mental health toolkit. So if you're a construction worker and you had the right hammer and the right saw and all of the tools you need, you could do your job well, and you could do it and it would be easier. And if you didn't have the tools, it would make your job really, really hard. And that's kind of the same as our mental health. We want to put strategies into our mental health toolkit to try to pull out. So even when you're maybe doing well, it's a really great time to put some strategies into your mental health toolkit. So you can pull those out and use them if you got to be in kind of a crisis state or if you watch someone around you. So it's our goal today to help you like gain some self-awareness of like, okay, do I have a mental health toolkit? Or I probably do. What do I use to cope? And yeah, so people who are self-aware, so this is, you can, sorry, it's so small. I'll read them out though. People with strong self-awareness skills can recognize their strengths and challenges, understand and talk about their needs, recognize other people's needs and feelings, see how their behavior affects others, develop a growth mindset, and learn from their mistakes, and know when to ask for help. So that's a lot of things. And obviously, we don't all do those very well. But that is a healthy way if you are working through your life and to have self-awareness. So self-awareness is an understanding of what is going on in our emotions, our thoughts, and our body. So emotions is kind of something we're going to focus on today. And emotions are subjective experiences that arise spontaneously and unconsciously in response to the environment around us. So if you were to ask, if I were to ask you today, what emotions did you have? Would you be able to think of like, okay, what did I experience today? Was I frustrated? How was I feeling? So if you can just think for a second, what emotions have I experienced today?
Maybe this could help you.
So this morning when we were getting ready for our session, we were like all ready, we're prepared, we're like feeling good. Our three kids are like safely and happily with my sister, and we're all good, we're here, we're on time. And we're all set up, and I go to pick up my coffee, and the whole thing poured down my entire front, like hot coffee, totally soaked with coffee. And so before that, a minute before, I was like so happy, I'm like, this is so great, I'm so happy to do this, this is great. And the next moment, I was feeling like annoyance, like really, like right when everything, it was like comedic, I had just said, this is all great, I'm really happy. And so in that moment, I was annoyed, but I was still happy to be here. So I was holding kind of two emotions at once, and that's a really important thing to hold, be able to recognize to hold two emotions at once. So emotions are a good thing, and they are very helpful to have them.
Yeah, so this idea of, like, emotions as topic, even this, what she just said, emotions are a good thing, it's actually, that's kind of a challenging statement sometimes in our culture, because emotions can be typically viewed as weakness in our culture, and sometimes it's like it's even like gendered or shamed to express emotion, depending on what kind of communities you've been part of. So like old school terms like, you know, boys don't cry, or man up, be a man, or oh, stop being so emotional. These kind of reveal the way that we kind of generally view emotions sometimes. It's more important to be rational and to not have emotion, right? That unfortunately that is a reality in a lot of the ways we've been kind of taught by what's around us. The reality is Christianity and Christian traditions have often done this too. Like the thought that like emotions are almost like deceptive, that they can lead you into foolishness, or even that they are sinful. I love the Bible verse that says, in your anger, do not sin. You know, like I think Christians, most of us, or from that perspective, kind of think of the negative range of emotions. We're like, oh, those are sinful. Those need to stop. But the reality is that's part of being human. They are good. They serve a purpose in your development and in your brain. But the reality is it's often the behavior that comes out of extreme emotion, that is sinful. Like sin is sin, right? But what you need to realize is that emotions are good, and emotions are part of how God's designed us, and that you have to like kind of come to terms with them. But there's kind of these social, you know, barriers sometimes to viewing emotion as good and even facing towards your own emotion. So we're advocating for like actually facing towards your emotion mm-hmm. as a good thing.
Yeah. So we're thinking of an example where we could kind of show you about emotions, and the one that came to our mind is the movie Inside Out. How many of you guys have seen Inside Out?
Lots classic,
of you.
Right?
So good classic. So I love it. It's one of my favorite movies because it shows like a different view of emotion in a really tangible way. And in the movie, Riley, the main character, is struggling with the big move she's making across the country. She's left her home, her friends, her family, everything she seems to love. And through the movie, you see how the emotions played out in her brain, our characters. So joy, sadness, anger, fear, disgust. But some of these emotions don't welcome the other ones. So their sadness kind of seems to be the villain. And in the movie, the other emotions don't want sadness to be anywhere near her. They're like trying to protect her from sadness. And so even joy pushes sadness away from any memories or any thing that could be close to what they perceive as a good memory. But what Riley really needs is to, we see kind of in the end of the movie that she actually needs to feel that sadness. It's a very important thing for her. She needs to feel that sadness over the loss of her move. And it's actually when joy and sadness work together, it's when the true core memories actually thrive and actually come back to life, when she's able to kind of hold both of those emotions. So we're just going to watch a quick clip of that. That kind of that gives us a kind of a reminder that it's actually when joy and sadness work together, she's able to find her tears. She's actually able to move through that emotion. She's no longer stuck in not being able to express emotion. She's actually able to move through it into a new stage. She realized that she can be sad that she's moved and lost things, but she also can be happy that her family are there for her, and she knows that they have her back no matter what. So there's a maturity in knowing that we can hold multiple emotions at one time. So when we can do a few things with difficult emotions when they happen. So our gut reaction is to push them away, but what we're going to suggest instead of pushing those emotions away is that we kind of go through them and actually look and find our tears the same way Riley did. So I really like this example. It's from the Gottman Institute. They talk about turning towards your emotions with acceptance. So just by like naming your emotions, become aware of the emotion and identify even where you see it in your body. The next one is identify and label the emotion. So this is anger. This is anxiety. I felt annoyed earlier today. Number three, accept your emotions. Don't deny it. Be like, no, I don't feel that way. I'm shutting that down. That's not a safe thing for me to do. Number four, realize the impermanence of your emotions. So this feeling is not going to last for forever. And if it does, if it is lasting a long time, that's something different. We'll talk about it in a minute. And it will pass. This will pass. Number five, inquire and investigate. Ask yourself, what triggered me? We're going to talk about triggers in a little bit. And why do I feel this way? And let go of the need to control your emotions. Like, no, you can't feel that. You're not allowed to feel that. Be open to the outcome of your emotions and what unfolds. So actually, if we do not process our emotion, it's actually really harmful to us. And we can swing from either two ways. We can feel nothing because we shut them all down, and that is very problematic. We can feel hopeless and numb, and the lack of that emotion actually can leave us feeling really depressed. Or we can swing the other way, where it lasts for too long and it doesn't feel tolerable, and we have fear and anxiety, and this prolonged combination of factors can result actually in an anxiety disorder. So there's multiple reasons for anxiety and depression. We're just presenting as emotion being a fuel for some of these things as well. The reality is that emotion will come out. It'll seep out. It'll find its way through the cracks and probably not how we want it to. And probably sometimes that might happen in a major panic attack, or that might happen in some other way of your body kind of not knowing exactly what to do with some of those big feelings. Oftentimes, like Riley, we've been taught that we should just get over it, push through it, but that is not the most helpful way through it.
Yeah, and like I'd mentioned before, you know, there's cultural kind of pressures and narratives sometimes that, you know, block us from really accessing those emotions. And they just are terrifying. It's like I think a lot of my adolescence, I was guarding myself against vulnerability, against my emotions, and using different strategies to cope that were unhealthy, right? It's another way of understanding a lot of the behavior we see in adolescence. You know, I think we're often way too hard on young people. But that being said, like, it's really important when you look at the Bible, when you look at our faith, you realize, if you really read the Bible, you realize that this is kind of crazy, but God is emotional. It's part of who he is. And it's actually a key part of how he related to his people. So we are made in the image of God as emotional people, relational, social, emotional, all that stuff's very intertwined and very intense, right? But what you see is that this is key for God's mission for human flourishing through Jesus. And the most beautiful part to me is that, you know, Jesus showed that he actually came down, God's willing to experience the full range of human emotion and the darkest depths of human emotion and the darkest consequences of the actions like violence that come out of human emotion. So he was willing to suffer, even suffer on a cross and die a humiliating death. And that's actually what we see is when he went through that, it's part of where he meets us. He actually wants to meet us. He's a God who meets us in and through our life experiences and in and through this emotional part of who we are. And he redeems through that. So, it's just really important to integrate this stuff into our faith. I've come to realize how important that is.
So anxiety, we just want to separate that anxiety and depression happen to you. They don't define you. So in my younger years, when I was very anxious about certain things, I could say, I'm Hannah, I am anxious. I am, that's who I am. And that's something happens to me. And so we kind of want to actually externalize that outside so that doesn't become our identity. It's going to inform who you are, but it's not, you are not anxious. You are not depressed. Those things happen to you. So we're going to watch a video in just a minute about anxiety and the truth about what anxiety and how it happens to us.
Yeah, and you'll notice this video references or alludes to, like, human evolution. So this is another one of those things. Please don't get sidetracked by faith, science, evolution, all that stuff. But what it's reporting about, like, how a human brain works is true and is really valuable for this conversation. Just a note on that.
You know what anxiety feels like. We all do. Everyone experiences anxiety in some way or another. It's something that connects all of us together. Why we feel anxiety and what it really is, that may surprise you. Without anxiety, we'd all be in serious trouble. As soon as your brain senses you're in danger, a little piece of it, called the amygdala, kicks in. It gets your body ready to react. That could mean fight, run away, or shut down. It's called the fight, flight, or freeze response. This reaction goes back millions of years to our distant animal ancestors. Animals whose amygdala were more sensitive to danger were more likely to stay alive and off the menu. Over millions of generations, this developed into the system we all know as anxiety. So you see, anxiety itself is not all bad. But when there's no immediate life or death threat, and your amygdala keeps telling your body that you're in danger, that's when anxiety becomes a problem. Your amygdala doesn't know the difference between getting eaten and public speaking or failing a test. Human society has only existed for a relatively short time. It's messy and complicated and confusing, and our amygdala just haven't had time to catch up. So sometimes, when we're in uncomfortable situations, our brains misread the risk and overreact. Our hearts beat faster and we breathe heavily, pulling more oxygen into our bodies. The muscles in our arms and legs tense up and fill with blood. Our skin perspires to cool us down. This would all be great if we needed to fight or run, but instead, we just feel tense and sweaty. Sometimes our minds go blank and we feel like we can't move or talk. That would be great if we needed to hide. Instead, we just feel stuck. When things trigger our anxiety, sometimes we try to avoid them, like our ancestors avoiding a predator. But that can cause problems when those triggers are important parts of life, like going to school or meeting new people, things that won't just give up and go away. So how does knowing all this help? Well, it starts with remembering what's really going on. There's nothing physically wrong with you. It's just your amygdala trying to tell you it thinks you're in danger, even if it gets confused about how much danger you're really in. Understanding why we feel anxiety is an important step in learning to manage it.
Yeah, so we can see that anxiety is our body protecting us. Whether it is a real threat, like we are actually in danger and we need protection, or perceived, it doesn't really matter. Our body can respond in the same way if our anxiety has been triggered. And so it's like, I like to think of it as like an alarm bell going off in your head, being like, danger, danger, danger. And when that goes off, our body prepares for the danger to come. And so I'm going to read a list of kind of what happens. I forgot that one. Okay, so these are the risk factors, and I'll go to the list. So there's many reasons that anxiety can happen. It can be a genetic predisposition, our brain chemistry, our family background, social influence, and lifestyle factors can all play into that. So these are some of the, so we have anxious feelings, thoughts, and physical symptoms. So it's like kind of a big thing. So these are, when I'm working with my clients in the office, we like to blow up anxiety. Let's fully understand what's going on for ourselves, because when we fully understand, it's less scary. We know what our body's doing and how it's reacting. And just by the knowledge of having that, we're able to say, oh, I know what's happening to me right now. I'm feeling detached from the body, or I'm feeling that things are strange or foggy. I'm feeling tense, uptight, on edge. All of these things. These are some of the feelings. Sometimes we can feel like we're going crazy. There's something, we have fears of illness, heart attack, or dying. Just have a read over those really quickly. And these are some of the thoughts that we can have when we experience anxiety. And these are some of the physical symptoms. So what's happening is when that alarm bell starts going off in our head, our body is getting the signal, you are in danger. So what happens is all of the oxygen, everything comes to our core, and it is starting to focus on keep your heart safe, keep yourself alive. And so sometimes we can feel that pressure in our chest, or we can feel like rapid heart rate, because literally your body is protecting itself in its core. So some people get like frozen fingers, kind of like this, or they can have numbling. their fingers can go tingly or numb, and it can affect our bowels. Like we can either like not go to the washroom or have to go to the washroom, and it's just kind of like all encompassing if we are feeling the physical symptoms to it.
One of my first like introductions to mental health was just witnessing a panic attack at a camp setting. You know, and I didn't know about mental health or what was happening, but I saw things there that weren't so much I didn't know what was going on, the thoughts or the feelings, but I was watching these physical things.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was just, I think it's really helpful or interesting to for understanding this and like kind of normalizing it, is to understand how this stuff works and that it's normal part of mm-hmm. your body's response.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a bunch of different treatment types. Often, like I said, not knowing is the scariest part. And so I don't think that any of these are perfect. Like none of them are the perfect treatment. And the same way that your anxiety will be very specific to you and what you experience, your treatment also needs to be specific to you. So that is why we try putting things in our toolbox to try to help ourselves get through those things. So some of those things can be medication. That's for people who've been experiencing it for a while and there doesn't seem to be any change, even through maybe the work of therapy or other work. So I would say medication with therapy is important to kind of be processing both of those things. Sometimes in your brain, chemicals actually get unbalanced, and sometimes your brain needs some help the same way. Sometimes we need eyeglasses to see. We would never say, just see better, just like be a little bit better. We would never say that. But sometimes with mental health, it's just like, get over it, like make your brain think better. Sometimes that doesn't work. Sometimes we need medication to make that help. And then other things like prayer, meditation, lifestyle choices, proper sleep, healthy diet. I would say all of these things are helpful to treat like a generalized anxiety disorder. So that's anxiety that's sticking around for longer than just the moments of everyday life. So there's some things that even thoughts can trigger anxiety. So another thing I like to do with my clients is work through something called cognitive distortion. So our brain is a muscle. And you know, when you work a muscle in a certain way, like if you're working out or exercising, it gets really used to doing that exercise and it's prepared for it. What happens? Our brain is the same. It's a muscle. And what happens with our brain is if we have a negative thought or like a negative. So I'll give you an example. So mine is kind of like, it's not on this list, but this is not also finite. There's lots of cognitive distortions. They're just main ones. Mine is what we call catastrophic thinking. So if something goes wrong, we have our three little children, and sometimes I'll be like, oh my goodness, Joe's at home. Where are our kids? Maybe they died in a car crash. And my brain goes like from nothing to everything in just a second. And I get major anxiety. And so that is a signal to me sometimes that maybe I'm actually struggling with anxiety. Maybe I'm actually not doing well if my thought is going automatic to a catastrophic thought. And so that is a cognitive distortion. That's not actually based in truth. That is just where my brain is going as a response to the anxiety that I'm experiencing at that moment. Make sense? So what we do is we want to break these down for ourselves. We all have cognitive distortions. Every one of us have these negative thought patterns. It's really important for us in our self-awareness to know, what are my negative thought patterns? So when we are triggered, when something happens, I can say, you know what? I'm familiar with this, and I have done a lot of therapy. And so I have spent a lot of time doing this for myself, and now I do this with my clients, is that when I'm triggered, I'm like, oh, that is touching on that thing in me, that negative emotion that my brain will go automatically to. So what we need to do, and so those pathways, sometimes I like to describe it, that muscle in your brain, like ruts in your brain. So what we need to do is we start to interject what we call the voice of truth. What is the truth about the situation? Well, the situation I gave you about, like, Joel coming home with the kids, he probably stopped for ice cream and went to the skate park. Like, because he's, like, really fun dad. He's way funner than me. So he probably did something really fun, and his phone died, the battery died, and that's probably just true. So what I have to do is I have to do that work myself. This is a me thing, and I have to understand that cognitive distortion, and then I have to do some grounding techniques or things to calm myself in that moment. And then I also am like, I think I'm not doing very well because my brain went right to this really negative thought. And so what we like to do also is to start to scale our anxiety. So you can do this for yourself at home. You can say, if my anxiety was 1 to 10, and today I was like a 2, like I was feeling a little bit like anxious, not feeling super great, but then it kept building, building, building. What would be my 10? So 10 might be like passing out. And the thing with anxiety is that you won't actually ever die. It won't kill you. Like you, most people won't have a heart attack because of it, but probably the worst thing is you could probably pass out from the lack of oxygen because you start to hyperventilate. So that's kind of like the worst result. And so what we want to do is we want to start to scale. Like, what are my 1 to 10? How do I go up there? And then we scale what happens to us, so maybe cognitive distortion, some of those symptoms. And on the other side, we think of coping strategies. Okay, 1 to 10, I'm going to try this thing. If I'm a 5, I'm going to try maybe some grounding exercises. Or maybe I'm going to go get some fresh air. Because when I get that fresh air, the oxygen goes into my brain and my amygdala is like, oh, you are okay right now. You're not in danger. And it gives us kind of like a little bit of a reset.
I was also going to say that, these negative patterns that are intrusive and like finding truth, like even that wording, that framework, like this is spiritual stuff, you know? Yes, this is, but it's both. That's the thing, right? It's brain chemistry. It's patterns, it's your experiences, it's all the stuff around you. But this is really, like, we often think of, like, this is where God wants to work, you know, and this is where your spiritual life can and should go if you can get into these deep places.
Right. Okay, so the next thing, we're going to just jump to depression. Like we said, this is, like, a very brief overview. We could teach a course on probably each one of these things, but we're just giving you a kind of an overview.
Depression is the leading cause of disability in the world. In the United States, close to 10% of adults struggle with depression. But because it's a mental illness, it can be a lot harder to understand than, say, high cholesterol. One major source of confusion is the difference between having depression and just feeling depressed. Almost everyone feels down from time to time. Getting a bad grade, losing a job, having an argument. Even a rainy day can bring on feelings of sadness. Sometimes there's no trigger at all. It just pops up out of the blue. Then circumstances change, and those sad feelings disappear. Clinical depression is different. It's a medical disorder, and it won't go away just because you want it to. It lingers for at least 2 consecutive weeks and significantly interferes with one's ability to work, play, or love. Depression can have a lot of different symptoms. A low mood, loss of interest in things you'd normally enjoy, changes in appetite, feeling worthless or excessively guilty, sleeping either too much or too little, poor concentration, restlessness or slowness, loss of energy, or recurrent thoughts of suicide. If you have at least 5 of those symptoms, according to psychiatric guidelines, you qualify for a diagnosis of depression. And it's not just behavioral symptoms. Depression has physical manifestations inside the brain. First of all, there are changes that could be seen with the naked eye and X-ray vision. These include smaller frontal lobes and hippocampal volumes. On a more micro scale, depression is associated with a few things: the abnormal transmission or depletion of certain neurotransmitters, especially serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine, blunted circadian rhythms, or specific changes in the REM and slow wave parts of your sleep cycle, and hormone abnormalities, such as high cortisol and deregulation of thyroid hormones. But neuroscientists still don't have a complete picture of what causes depression. It seems to have to do with a complex interaction between genes and environment, but we don't have a diagnostic tool that can accurately predict where or when it will show up. And because depression symptoms are intangible, it's hard to know who might look fine but is actually struggling. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, it takes the average person suffering with a mental illness over 10 years to to ask for help. But there are very effective treatments. Medications and therapy complement each other to boost brain chemicals. In extreme cases, electroconvulsive therapy, which is like a controlled seizure in the patient's brain, is also very helpful. Other promising treatments, like transcranial magnetic stimulation, are being investigated too. So if you know someone struggling with depression, encourage them, gently, to seek out some of these options. You might even offer to help with specific tasks, like looking up therapists in the area, or making a list of questions to ask a doctor. To someone with depression, these first steps can seem insurmountable. If they feel guilty or ashamed, point out that depression is a medical condition, just like asthma or diabetes. It's not a weakness or a personality trait, and they shouldn't expect themselves to just get over it, any more than they could will themselves to get over a broken arm. If you haven't experienced depression yourself, avoid comparing it to times you've felt down. Comparing what they're experiencing to normal temporary feelings of sadness can make them feel guilty for struggling. Even just talking about depression openly can help. For example, research shows that asking someone about suicidal thoughts actually reduces their suicide risk. Open conversations about mental illness help erode stigma and make it easier for people to ask for help. And the more patients seek treatment, the more scientists will learn about depression, and the better the treatments will get.
So, so depression symptoms, we can kind of like boil it down to two core symptoms of depression are low mood and loss of interest in activities. And then these other things could happen, changes of appetite, trouble sleeping, tiredness, feelings of guilt, trouble concentrating, and thoughts of death. Don't be scared by the shock therapy that you heard there. That's extreme cases. Most of us don't have to go through that if we deal with depression, but I just wanted to remind us that that's an extreme case. So here's some of the risk factors. So early trauma and abuse. We don't have time to touch on trauma and the impact it has, but it has a huge impact on our mental health. Hormones, genetics, personality, brain chemistry, poverty, and chronic illness. And then, like again, here's some of our symptoms, low mood, change in appetite, meditation. So depression wants to keep us down and isolated, alone. It wants to keep us kind of those stuck feeling. It amplifies our mistakes and our failures and minimizes our successes. We did so in that moment, you can't be proud of yourself. You can't hold that emotion. You're like, no, I still like really sucked at that, or I can't think of positive thoughts for myself. So what happens when these two areas of depression and anxiety escalate? Sometimes that can put us into a crisis state, and this can be the crisis state is something that we are going to kind of just talk about for a second. This is what I like to use in our therapy setting, is we like to understand it as kind of the window of tolerance. So these are two different spots, kind of the same thing. So if this is our window right here, and right here, this is where I'm living my life. I have a good day, and I have a bad day, and it's mostly tolerable. I'm kind of like going through my life. I might go through like a little bit of a sad time. I dip into here and kind of come up again, and I'm kind of learning to live in this window. I'm kind of going through my life like this. But what happens is if anxiety is activated, so we can start to feel threatened, and we can go to hyperarousal. So that's the feelings of kind of being unsafe. So anxiety, panic, restlessness, hyperactivity, hypervigilance, sleeplessness. So I like to think of this kind of anxiety down here, and then on the other way, overwhelm up here, irritability. We can go from all the way from hyperarousal all the way down to hypoarousal. So down here, it's kind of we go first to I'm feeling flustered and avoiding, and then we go to freeze. I'm overwhelmed, and this looks like depression, numbness, chronic pain, chronic fatigue, disconnect, disassociation, exhaustion, complex syndromes, and poor digestion can happen down there as well. So our goal as a therapeutic person with our therapeutic toolkit is to try and keep us in our window here. What's tolerable for me, and am I able to kind of stay within my window of tolerance? We're not going to always be able to do that, but if we have a toolkit, we know, okay, if I go up into here, instead of crashing down into here, maybe I can lower myself down into here slower. So we want to understand, where's our window of tolerance? Where are we calm, cool, collected, connected? So in stress, our window shrinks. So things that are normally tolerable aren't really tolerable for us anymore, and we can bounce in and out of there. Also, trauma. If we, like I mentioned before, if we have significant trauma that's undealt with in us, our window is very, very small. We can bounce in and out of there often. So when we're functioning out of our window of tolerance, that's when harmful coping strategies and other things can kind of happen to us, like suicidal ideation.
Yeah, so I just wanted to speak a little bit about suicidal ideation. I think what's really important to note is, like the video said, actually talking about dying by suicide is important for decreasing the risk. Sometimes we think, oh, if we talk about it, it'll like make it worse or it'll give people ideas, but it's really proven that the best thing that a person who is having suicidal ideation can do, or what they need, is to actually get that out into a relationship, get that out into the open, bring that to the light. That's what like kind of disempowers that. One image for this that I found helpful that Hannah's talked about is like, it's almost like a tornado. And like, if you have suicidal ideation, which 10% of us in this room will have had or could have in the future, it's like you start to feel a pull. And it's like a pull into that tornado. And what if you really isolate with some of that ideation, the ideation will get worse. And if you stay isolated, that's when it can get to the worst point where someone would choose to die. They feel like it's actually the only option. It's the only rational choice. It's the only way to alleviate the pain. When in reality, a lot of time people with suicidal ideation don't want to die, and they actually want help and they're willing to accept help, but there's like kind of mixed feelings about that. So, getting that out into the open and talking about that is important, but it's super scary to do, you know, with our friends and with people we know. So this is where I really want to say that, like, you know, peer support is good, but you actually do need trusted adults involved in these conversations. So if this stuff comes out, you know, there's even things like crisis helplines if there's a crisis situation, but just like working with safe adults and taking immediate action. I think it's really important, like, I've even heard jokes about suicide and things like that in different contexts. But whenever someone speaks about their own death or suicide, just this has been my new takeaways, is always treat it real and show that person you care and just check in with them. Hey, are you having thoughts of death or dying? Are you thinking about that? And show them that it's real. Because even if it is a joke, or if it isn't a joke, it just, what I've realized, there's nothing to lose by doing that. And to treat it as serious, though, is really important as well. And also, just to trust your gut feeling. If you know someone, and you know they're not doing well, and there's some talk like that, get help. And get professional help. Mm-hmm. And, yeah.
So as a friend, then, we interrupt that cycle. And even if it is just for a few minutes, it helps us to, like, withdraw from the tornado or that cycle, and maybe it can bring us back up to the top, and it's not as powerful, not as strong anymore. So we kind of want, it's really important, actually, to interrupt that cycle for somebody. And people can work through it. There can be seasons then when that is not a big and is a real a possibility for them. And so there's no shame in having those thoughts, but there's a way for us to kind of work through those thoughts and help you not struggle or suffer alone. The next one is self-harm. So self-harm, we can think of it as a coping mechanism. It's not it's not the most healthy one, but it is a coping mechanism. It's something people use as a way to deal with overwhelm, lots of feelings or no feelings at all, where they're disassociating. So it's a cycle, as you can read up there. Many people who self-injure can go through periods in and out of self-harm. So unless people find more healthy ways to cope, they're likely to turn to self-injury to manage their stressful feelings or negative emotions that they don't know what to do with. And so this is something that's often done kind of in private, so lots of us don't know that this is going on for people. But if you recognize that with somebody, as a counselor, it's kind of crazy, but our first goal is not to get them to immediately stop. That's not our goal, because that's actually, their strategy is working for them right now, but it is not a long-term strategy. So what our goal is then too, is to start finding ways for them to find other strategies to work through those really painful moments where they feel like that is maybe one of their only options. And so it's, like, again, normalizing, talking about these things, reaching out to friends, not struggling or suffering alone is kind of the goal that can help us work through some of these areas. So we're just going to we're going to wrap up here in a few minutes. But we just want to give you some options. If you are in a crisis state, this is kind of what we can kind of suggest is notice, like we talked about, notice how and what you're feeling, like what emotion that is happening. Noticing even where in your body you're feeling it. Do a grounding technique, and I'll show you an example of those in a couple seconds, and then tell someone about it. It's kind of our strategy. So here's a few grounding techniques, and if you want to take a picture of these for yourself, or there's going to be two different slides here. I really like this one. What we're doing is when we are feeling in that crisis state, we actually have to send a signal to our alarm bell that it is okay. And so that's why we use our physical body to send that signal to our amygdala in that moment. And so there's some five things you can see around you, four things you can touch, three things you can hear, two things that you can smell, and one thing that you taste. I love this one. You can do this in school. If you're all of a sudden feeling panic or if you're all of a sudden feeling anxiety increase, you can use this as a tool to kind of, we call it grounding ourselves, to send that signal that right now you are okay, you're going to make through it, this is going to pass, and we're going to be able to move through. The next one, here's another grounding practice, different grounding practices. So they often have to do with our body, just to send those signals to our body that we are okay. So the five senses there again, self-soothing. You can hold ice cubes. This sometimes works in self-harm. If you're feeling the urge, we need to do something different as coping strategy in that moment to even distract. So you can hold ice cubes, and you can just notice how they feel. They're melting through my fingers. It's kind of uncomfortable. That's kind of cold. That doesn't feel great. But it's actually better than inflicting injury in that moment. So we can observe things around us. We can breathe. Something I like to do is square breathing. So like we talked about before, that oxygen is just like wanting to get there. So if we can slowly breathe and we can send that signal, you are getting enough oxygen, it is okay. That really helps our nervous system kind of regulate in that moment. So what I like to do is square, so I visualize a square or I find a square in a room, and then I go around it. So I breathe in for 4 seconds, breathe out for 4 seconds, breathe in for 4 seconds, breathe out for 4 seconds, and do that. I do like a few rounds of that. And then that just kind of helps me, and I can kind of work through whatever that really strong, overwhelmed feeling is at that moment. So this is a really, really important. And I'm going to key in on, so owning our own story can be hard, but not nearly as difficult as spending our lives running from it. So not being aware of ourselves. Embracing our vulnerabilities is risky, but not nearly as dangerous as giving up on the love and belonging and joy, the experiences that make us the most vulnerable. So only when we, this is really important, only when we are brave enough to explore the darkness, will we discover the infinite power of our light. So when we're able to kind of go to those dark places, those scary places, those places maybe we don't really want to talk about or we feel uncomfortable with, this quote, by the way, is by Brené Brown. She's so awesome. And when we're willing to go there, that is when we start to be able to move through and forward. And so our challenge to you today is to consider where you are in your therapeutic journey. So you do things to cope. You've gotten here. You're alive today. You've already done things. And so we want to identify those helpful things we're doing and maybe even the unhelpful things we're doing. And the goal of the therapeutic journey is to keep moving forward, understanding that we've come through suffering and we've been able to learn about ourselves through that. So this is another thing I like to show clients. This is the goal. So as we're working through our mental health, there's nothing magical that'll fix that instantly. There's nothing, that's not life or reality. And so I really like to like think about this. So maybe for some of you, your mental health feels like this right now. It's like eating you up, it's swallowing you up. It's so big, it feels overwhelming. But this is the goal. That not that something magically happens and it goes away, but actually that it minimizes. So this is a very self-aware person. She's able to say, hey, sometimes I still feel a little bit of anxiety, but now I know what to do with it. I've like practiced my words, and my brain is used to working through some of these overwhelming feelings. And so now she's just like, okay, buddy, what's up? And this is the therapeutic journey. This is how we move forward, finding strategies as we're going through life. And it's a really great for us to be able to respond to our own suffering. Suffering is going to happen to us. Mental health in different seasons is going to help to us in negative ways. And so how we navigate that is kind of talking to us about our therapeutic journey.
Yeah. And that's, the therapeutic journey is the faith journey. Like from Isaiah 61, right? Like this is part of God's mission for your life, for this world, that you can participate in for yourself and help others with. And these hopefully have been just like some tools for that, or an introduction to be like, oh, I could explore those tools or kind of go further with that. But yeah, it's a beautiful part of being human. It's a beautiful part of having faith in Jesus Christ is going to these levels with him. And there are so many important resources for this journey in our faith communities, in our faith practices. All the things that Jesus taught and did point to the best science's answers for the problems of mental health, which is really cool. He connects us socially. There's like freedom and forgiveness and light. All these things, they're just, you can see the connections and the integration possibilities. So I just really encourage you to do that. I also want to make the note that, you know, it's often, these weekends are emotional. These weekends are pushing you beyond the limits of your body and your mind. But really, these weekends are like powerful times where you can access some of those things. And many people have kind of breakthroughs or even miraculous kind of personal experiences or whatever. But what I've often seen, and even from my own journey, is think about this experience this weekend being part of what your life is going to be like 10 years down the road as an adult. And integrate it. Like it, enjoy and experience and give yourself to God fully, you know, at that emotional level, in that whole level, and then work. It's a journey. It's a lifelong journey. It's a following of Jesus. And we just hope that you can kind of learn how to do that at this level with tools like this, with people. Most important thing is people. We talked a lot about self-regulating. One of the best things you can do, one of the even quicker or faster, is if you have someone who's truly safe, that you truly trust, that you know, and has your best interest, they can help you co-regulate. And it's like Riley crying with her parents, right? If you can let that, their nervous system regulates yours. And it actually can be a very healing experience. Get prayer. Like, that's an example of that, right? So all I'll say is find someone safe, reach out to them, let them know how you're doing with your mental health, be self-aware of your mental health. Mm-hmm. And thank you guys so much for this opportunity.
Mm-hmm. So we'll just wrap up here. One more thing. As we're becoming a therapeutic person, we want to ask the question, am I aware of my own health, mental health? So where have you gained resilience, what you suffered? And we hope that through your learning today that you learn something new, maybe about yourself. We always want to ask, I ask this to my clients all the time, is there something that stood out to you? And if there's something that stood out to you, that means we always think that there's something there. There's something I need to think more about. So if, as you saw some of those examples, or if you're like, oh, I've had that symptom, it's your job now to take that information and be like, okay, therapeutically, what do I need to do with that? And so what we're going to do is we're going to leave a list of questions. They're kind of small, but we're going to leave a list of questions. You can come and take a picture of them. And they're kind of questions to get you started, kind of like start asking some of like, where, how am I doing? I don't know a question to ask myself. So I'm going to start by asking some of these questions of myself. So yeah, so if you have any questions of us, we're going to give you some time. We're going to end our session here kind of formally, and you can come talk to us. We talk to people for a living. We're really good at that. So you can come talk to us if you need. And then, yeah, have a great rest of your weekend.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jess.
Where did you go to study for psychology?
I actually did my master's.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Because I'm wanting to go into psychology now, and I don't know what I want to do. So originally, I was thinking of doing going to talk.